Welcome to Mysterious Japan, created by Heath Havey and dedicated to the dark histories, ghost stories, and frightful folklore of Japan. These are the stories that give nightmares to the Japanese. Listener discretion is advised.
Welcome to episode 15 of Mysterious Japan. In this special episode, we deviate from the dark history and supernatural folklore and instead take a look at the strange, mysterious, and sometimes funny Japan. Part 1. Sons and Lovers. Hiro knows this will be the best week of his life. In just a few days, he will get married. He will begin a life of wedded bliss with his sister. Yes, with his sister. This tale does not come from medieval times, nor is it a tale of incestuous, forbidden love. No, this story comes from the present day. It is not a singular, strange tale. It will not even make the news. It is a common story in Japan, and a common practice. Brothers marrying their sisters. This practice is not frowned upon by society. Even the bride's strict and traditional parents support her marrying her brother. In fact, it was her father's idea. But why is this? Just last week, the bride's parents adopted Hiro. He has been adopted before marrying his bride-to-be. But why adopt an adult who can take care of himself? What is necessary about this adoption if he is to marry into the family anyway? To understand this, we must pry a little deeper into Japan culture and law. Adult men between the ages of 20 and 30 make up 98% of adoptions in Japan. Think about this for a moment. Only 2% of adoptions in Japan involve children. This practice of adopting adult men began hundreds of years ago with the adoption of Japan's civil code. During the Tokugawa shogunate from the 17th century to the mid-19th century, Japan's law under the civil code mandated that generational wealth was only allowed to be passed down to a son, not to a daughter. This law continued through the Second World War. What it meant was that the eldest son was next in line. If there were no sons, or if the sons were considered unsuitable heirs, problems could arise upon death of the father. To bypass this, families without sons adopted male adults to maintain the family name, businesses, and wealth through their daughter and her husband. In recent years, this means that male adults are still adopted into the family to ensure there are no issues concerning passing the wealth to future family generations. Thus, Hiro has gained the same family in two different ways in the space of 1 week. By being adopted by his boss, who is also his father-in-law, he has taken on himself the last name of both his boss and soon-to-be wife, and thus has become both a son and a son-in-law. This is known as mukoyoshi in Japanese. For over a century, adoption has been called the cornerstone of family law in Japan. Unlike many Western countries, formal adoption remains important in Japanese culture. Part of this owes to the peculiarities of the Shinto religion, which focuses on ancestors and preservation of the family. The use of ancestral tablets of ancestors continues to make this practice important from the religious standpoint. In addition to legal and cultural standpoints, attempts to diminish the importance of the system after World War II and to adopt Western standards have all failed. Instead, the concept of family is fluid and extends beyond just the nuclear family that dominates the Western consciousness. Perhaps even stranger to the Westerner is that there are no age requirements. Older people can be adopted by younger people, though it would be impossible to have a biological parent-child relationship. And legally, there is no more need for judicial validation by the government or the courts about who will be adopted. You are as free to choose whom to adopt as you are to choose whom you will marry. All of it is left to private agreement. An interesting historical note here is that when adoptions were deregulated in 1600 CE, only the warrior class was closely regulated. Why was this? Because adoption into the samurai class affected stipends received by the samurai's family from the government. In more recent years, adoption becomes part of estate tax planning to reduce the taxes paid after death when passing on part of the estate to a son-in-law. This has given the tax bureau no end of headaches because adoptions are substituted for wills and tax evaders can be hard to find. Early 20th century foreigners found themselves confused to enter a house and find half a dozen or more people calling themselves parents and children with no genetic ties between them. The practice of arranged marriage in Japan is known as omiai. Companies exist in Japan that will look for and recruit potential male adoptees for company bosses and, of course, their daughters. Though the law is now archaic, there is another reason why the practice continues today. through adopting their future son-in-law, company presidents can still boast publicly and truthfully that their company is a family-run business. Did you ever wonder why Suzuki can legitimately claim it is a family-run business? It is because the current CEO of Suzuki, Osamu Suzuki, is the fourth son to be adopted to run the company. Four generations of arranged marriages and adoptions to keep the company as a family-run business. This has all worked well for Suzuki and many other companies. But will this bizarre and dated trend end? If so, when? The answer is probably not soon. Japan's aging population is increasing dramatically, while birth rates continue to plummet. These demographics mean that companies continue more than ever to adopt adults to keep the family name alive. This maintains the legacy of the family and the company. Until there is a change in this disparity of ages among the Japanese, this practice will likely continue for at least several more generations. It is believed that 55% or more adoptions in Japan are made solely to adopt sons-in-laws. To the Japanese mind, adopting a young child may mean that the child grows up into an adult without the aptitude or interest in taking over the family business, but adopting an adult son who already has the skills and desire to take over the business is a wiser choice. Indeed, in one study, 24% of son-in-law adoption cases already had a son in the family, but one who was not in a position to adequately take over the business. Mothers also prefer the adoption of son-in-laws. In Japanese culture, the idea of so-called marrying out daughters means the daughter will join another family. But the mothers want their daughters to remain in their own family and take care of them when they are elderly. Thus, adopting the son-in-law is preferred. They get to keep their daughters close at home. But what about the daughters? They too prefer this arrangement. Culturally, they see this as an ability to enter the workforce and have their mothers help with childcare and household tasks, and they get to spend more time with their parents. The lucky young men like Hiro are both sons and lovers, and someday they will be company presidents, meritocracy be damned. Or perhaps this is the meritocracy working when it can be best judged. In other words, when an adequate heir can be selected directly. But is all good for Hiro? No, it is not all good news. His family may not want to give up a son in the declining birth rate of Japan. For him personally, by being adopted, he occupies the same position as a woman marrying into her husband's family. His wife has more authority than he does, and he has a lower social status. He gives up his last name and takes on the name of his wife's family. He also knows he will have to prioritize taking care of his wife's family in old age compared with his own biological parents. The next question, especially in modern days, is this. What happens in the case of a divorce? If he refuses to agree to dissolving the adoption, his adoptive parents must find some sort of legal fault with him. And if the opposite occurs, dissolution of the adoption is not grounds to get a divorce. Despite this unique and unusual practice in Japan, listeners will be glad to hear that brothers and sisters can only marry if they do not share a biological parent. But an odd law connected to that is that the adopted child may never marry an adopted parent or child, even if there are no blood ties. Why is this? Because historically, Japan has put great emphasis on the vertical ties in a household since ancient times. This is called the house system, where the eldest son establishes the main house, or honkei. Allowing these discordant parent-child marriages would disrupt this traditional system. Believe it or not, Japan adoptions do get stranger. Let's look at adoption of a group of people who are not future sons-in-laws. Part 2, adopting your girlfriend. So we said the adopted person could never marry the person adopting them. But that does not stop the Japanese from adopting their mistresses. The adoption practice has also been used to adopt extramarital lovers. Why is this? Why go to this trouble? The answer is simple, if not palatable to many Westerners. It reduces inheritance taxes to pass the estate to a mistress. This is also one way some Japanese men have evaded Japan's bans against homosexual marriage. By adopting their homosexual lover, they can create similar ties that a spouse may have, even without a marriage. One of the strangest of these cases reached the Japan Supreme Court in 1971. A daughter contested her 70-year-old father from adopting his 43-year-old biological niece. In other words, her cousin. She claimed the adoption could not be sustained because they also had a sexual relationship. This tested the idea of legal adoption against the taboo of incest between an uncle and niece. Perhaps a bit surprisingly, the court found that the adoption was valid regardless of the sexual relationship as long as both had consented. Where a spouse is involved, both spouses must consent to the adoption. The court hinted that the result might be different if they were trying to get married, but a change in the law in 1988 did away with this requirement as to adults. This means that an adult can adopt another adult even without consent of a spouse. This, of course, opened the door to more widespread adoption of mistresses as daughters, and many lawsuits by wives followed. Many Japanese men believe that adopting a lover attracted less societal condemnation than a divorce, and thus these secret adoptions continue to this day. But according to the courts, the only way to circumvent a valid adoption is to show that it was entered into to avoid divorce laws, such as to reduce what the ex-spouse would receive in a divorce, or purchase sexual favors through the relationship. This becomes a problem when a wife's husband dies and she only finds out about the adopted lover after his death. Before she can sue to recover the lover's share of the estate, she must first successfully have the adoption dissolved. This can be avoided if the husband provided for the lover in a will, but since such affairs are normally kept secret, such is usually not the case, leading to more trouble for the bereft spouse. As far back as 1912, a Japanese legal commentator said,
"What is done in Europe and America by will is done in Japan by adoption. Instead of giving away property to another person by will, which becomes effective after death, a Japanese takes another person into his house by adoption during his lifetime and makes the latter the expectant successor to his property."
The social context for adopting mistresses is rooted in Japanese culture. For generations, Japanese culture has shown a high tolerance for extramarital relationships. A famous Japanese anthropologist named Taki Libra called it institutionalized tolerance of, or even support of, male promiscuity. She pointed out that a wife showing patience with her husband's promiscuity is considered an admirable trait in Japan. The traditional thought was that as long as husbands provide well for their dependents, including their wives, and as long as they treat them with respect, there should not be conflict between wives and mistresses. This was a burden borne by many wives in Japan. Even if they did harbor extreme feelings against a mistress, wives believed they had to tolerate the affairs because their status as wives needed to be kept secure. Divorce could ruin them. In fact, until 1883, men were able to register their mistresses on part of their family registry. Mistresses were treated as secondary wives or concubines from the legal perspective. In recent years, expectations of marriage have changed somewhat, and greater access to financial independence has increased the willingness to articulate displeasure with their husband's infidelity. But this cultural and traditional anchor still shows through in actions such as the adoption of mistresses. Listeners will be relieved to learn that this adoption scenario, unlike the adoption of sons-in-law, will likely not survive too much longer as women grow in strength, power, and independence in Japan's modern society and as divorce becomes destigmatized. Part 3, an indelicate act. We leave the adoption topic and all its strangeness to explore something that may knock the wind out of you or crack you up if, in fact, you don't think the topic stinks. Yes, we are talking about flatulence in medieval Japan. If you don't stay for the humor, then you may want to stay for the unique Japanese history on this topic. We offer apologies in advance for this indelicate subject, but Japan's treatment of this most natural and human of behaviors is steeped in tradition quite different from the rest of the world. Believe it or not, Japan has a rich history of stories involving flatulence as their main subject. Let us look first at the cultural view of flatulence during medieval times. From the 17th to 19th century, farting in public was considered shameful, especially by noble women. Some Japanese high-class women were known to attempt suicide if they committed such a faux pas in public. But what is a woman to do when the inevitable happens? As a deterrence, some ladies of the nobility hired an assistant called a heioi bakuni to follow them around. If the lady farted in public, the heioi bakuni would say, "I did it," and take the blame for the fart. Just whose fault is the fart? Whoever claimed it. Thus, the noblewoman could pass on taking blame for the gas. A famous story in the 18th century treats this subject without the humor it probably deserves. One night during a full moon, love is in the air. A nobleman named Fujiwara flirts with a noblewoman. She is reputed to be beautiful, but she stands on the other side of a bamboo screen. After amorous talk continues for some time, Fujiwara can take it no more. He opens the curtain between them, grabs her, and pulls her close for a kiss. He thought this was romantic, but she squirms in his grip. "What are you doing?" she asks. His actions were so quick and unexpected that something tragic happens right then. She farts loudly. Embarrassed by this breach of etiquette, she falls to the ground and collapses in tears. Fujiwara mutters that he has had a hard time in love, and now this tragedy has befallen him. He says, "This world is a waste of time. I shall shave my head and become a monk." He leaves her quietly as she still lays collapsed in mortified tears on the ground. 3 steps away, he reconsiders, "Why should I become a monk?" Because she made the mistake of farting, so he quits his idea of becoming a monk and instead runs away from the farting noble woman, leaving her alone in her shame. He refuses to take the fault for her fart, but also refuses to be with a woman who made such an embarrassing, even if uncontrollable, mistake. Part 4. Following in the footsteps of the king of farts and failing. The following story, called Fukutami Zoshimo no Gatari, comes from a 15th century illustrated scroll that was drawn and scribed many times for the next 400 years. It is one of the oldest such scrolls. The title literally means the old rich man's story, but because the word fuku also means to blow, it carries an obvious double meaning. The story is set in Kyoto during the Muromachi period of the early 15th century. Orabe possessed a unique gift, a talent he could perform without any practice. He was so good at this that he turned it into an art form, achieved great fame, and some even looked at him as a god incarnate. Though his art was vulgar, everyone in life is familiar with it in some form. And since Orabe was so humorous and good at it, he was even invited to perform before the aristocracy. Orabe grew in happiness and wealth by exploiting his gift of flatulence. He was known far and wide as the king of farts. Next door to Orabe lived a poor man named Toda. He could not afford wood to burn in his chimney, and weeds overgrew his gardens. He was so poor he had to use the eaves of his roof as firewood. In winter, he froze as cold winds blew into his house. In summer, he wore only hemp robes while he swatted away mosquitoes with an old folding fan. He had married young to a woman much older than himself. She had an enormous mouth and earned the nickname Oni Yuba, meaning the old lady demon. In Japan, demons were believed to have oversized mouths. One day, she said to her husband,
"Even Orabe, who belongs to none of the upper classes, can make a great fortune just by farting far and wide. He has only that one strange art to display to the world, yet look at his prosperity. I think you must have done something terrible in a previous life to have been born in this poor state, without even such a talent as his. Why can't you at least learn the art of farting like Orabe? Ask him for lessons. Let him be your master. Maybe you can at least make enough money to get by. If you don't, I'll leave you. With my face, I will have my choice of men."
Put in fear by his wife's words, Toda went next door and Orabe graciously offered to teach him. But Toto went overboard in his obsequious behavior to the point that Orabe was offended by the begging, groveling nature of his poor neighbor. So he decided to play a trick on him.
"You must first take a medicine before you perform. It is a secret. Don't tell anyone."
He gave the list of ingredients and 2 sample pills to Toto for his first performance. Then Orabe gave him advice.
"Don't take these on an empty stomach. Eat lots of food exactly 4 hours before you perform, and wash them down with salt water. If they don't take effect quickly, scoop some water into a tub, dunk your behind in the tub, and hold your breath."
Toda's delighted wife said he must now proclaim to the world that he is the disciple of the great Orabe, She said he must do a trial run, so he took the food and pills as instructed and took off for the residence of the samurai captain nearby, who was known to reward performances with gifts. As he walked, his stomach lurched and growled. When he arrived, he announced himself to the captain's retainers. The captain, intrigued, had Tota sit in the garden on a mat with him and his retainers. He gave Tota lavish food and wine. By now, Tota's stomach hurt and clenched, but he concentrated on the delicious food. But the cramps were too much. His stomach started to spasm. He got up to excuse himself. But it was too late. From his behind, a spray more powerful than a geyser erupted, staining all over the white pebble courtyard. The captain, his retainers, and all the food for the banquet were covered by the unfortunate spray. A stench rose, and the disgusted captain and retainer started to flee. Tota pushed his butt cheeks together, but not in time. The servants and houseboys jumped down and began beating him with whips and sticks. They chased him out of the courtyard. By the time he escaped, blood was seeping from his injured head and his now ripped open bottom. Children pointed and laughed as he walked home. Shop owners refused to let him rest near their shops or on benches because of the hideous stench. His wife saw him approaching from afar. He seemed to wear crimson robes, and a crowd of people followed him. She told herself,
"We will be poor no more. He has been gifted with crimson robes. The captain must have loved his performance. We will be rich now. We mustn't be seen in rags."
So she burned all the extra clothes in the house, throwing them right into the chimney to start a fire. When Tota entered, his crimson robe was nothing but his normal rag stained in blood. The crowd was no more than children mocking and laughing at him. With his clothes burnt, Tota stripped naked and sat miserably on the floor. All night and the following day, his stomach cramped. The scrolls say, quote,
"All that night and the following day, evening mist rose from his behind, and it seemed that nocturnal insects chirped from inside his guts. His bowels emptied constantly like rain from the autumn skies, fitfully stopping and starting."
He moaned in pain from spasms of diarrhea, and his wife was furious with him, but she tried to warm her hands and massage his stomach. This only caused a smell to rise from his bowels that made her gag. Days and nights passed, but he only grew weaker. He could not even walk to the toilet. He would instead put on his clogs, lean over the garden, and, quote, spray out large quantities of liquid. His throat was constantly parched, but every time he drank, his body would expel the water. At last, his wife was able to obtain some medicine from the doctor, despite having no money. The doctor was convinced that Tota's life hung in the balance. His wife was not called the demon mouth wife for nothing. She determined to get revenge on Oribe for tricking her husband. She called out a Buddhist curse on him. Then she cast a Shinda curse on him. She would not let this go. Oribe began having terrible nightmares. He consulted an oracle who said he must fast and go on a pilgrimage. The demon mouth wife was not satisfied yet. She waited for Oribe to return, and then she seized him fiercely with the look of a real demon in her face. Frightened, Oribe wrenched out of her grip. But she chased him. She clamped her oversized mouth on his chest and bit him, shaking her head back and forth like a rabid dog. And then her eyeballs rolled up, her mouth split open all the way to the ears, and passersby cried out,
"It's a people-eating demon. Run away."
But others gawked in fascination at the sight. Nearby, two minstrels were awakened by the commotion outside. They thought wild beasts had come, and they fled in fear. The captain thought that her growling came from his dogs, and he grabbed his bow and arrows to shoot the culprit. But those watching were crying out, "Demon," and "Demon," and the frightened captain returned home and shut his windows and doors. Tota's wife had taken her revenge. The moral of this scatological farce story is typically found to be, do not envy the good fortune of others, for their lot in life and path to success may not be yours. But his wife's revenge adds an additional humorous dynamic to the story. Part 5. The Flatulence Battles. A Buddhist painter is credited with creating the first picture scroll depicting a fart battle. This picture scroll, created around 1110 to 1125, emphasizes the smell and sheer force of farting. This marks a departure from the typical Japanese portrayal of flatulence, making it humorous rather than shameful. These were typically made to provide social criticism. In fact, the 15th century seems to be the golden age of flatulence in Japan. Detailed picture scrolls called Heigassen depict epic battles using flatulence as the main weapon. Many of the artists are unknown, and some fart battles are painted into sliding doors or screens. But perhaps the most famous of the fart battle scrolls is a 34-foot-long scroll created in 1846 by enlarging an old map made in the 17th century. It is called Heigassen Emaki. Now it must first be explained that he is considered an elegant expression for fart used as slang by the women of the imperial court. It is a secret alteration of the term onarashi, which means a ringing fart, into a more palatable word meaning a woman's squeak. These picture scrolls tell a story by reading them from right to left, and this one is about 18 screens long. In the first screen, the samurai and his servants sit in a circle discussing something while one points in the distance with an elated smile on his face. In the next screen, a rival group of samurai are making their own secret plans. Screen 3 shows the two groups of samurai meeting and talking, perhaps challenging each other to battle. In screen 4, they sit around two pots boiling potatoes over open fires. They eat as many potatoes as they can because they need to fill their stomachs with gas. They cannot fight this kind of battle if they are hungry. The battle begins in the 5th screen. They bend over and let the force of their wind attack the enemy. One enemy holds his nose, falling on his back, while one of the other team has his hat blown off by the extreme force of the gas. In screen 6, three naked men bend over and shoot out their flatulence and triangular beams at three others. One of those being attacked holds up a wooden board to shield himself from the farts, while the other two fight back. Three butts face three other butts just a couple arms lengths away. This is hand-to-hand or butt-to-butt combat at its finest. The 7th screen shows a new defense. One team uses giant fans to wave back the farts of the other team. The flatulence arches backwards, engulfing them in their own gases. The 8th screen shows the strongest farter shoot his gas so hard that it breaks a hole in the wooden shield. As his two teammates behind the shield fall down, the third bends over and expels gas in the face of the strongest farter. But unhindered, the strongest man has no reaction, and he says,
"What a cool spring breeze."
The 9th screen shows a new member joining one side, and the force of the combined winds is so great that two of the other team fall into each other plugging noses, while the third has his own wind blown right back at him. The 10th screen starts a new stage of battle. Both teams have brought out large bags to collect their farts. Screen 11 shows what they are doing as the bag is pointed at the enemy and open, releasing a gale of gas that topples over the enemy, knocking off shoes in the process. In screen 12, the enemy tries a new tactic of riding by on horses and farting as they pass by their opponents. One is knocked into the air while his teammate just laughs at him. Screen 13 shows sweet revenge as one of the farters knocks the horse over with the strength of his flatulent stream. In screen 14, two women are brought into the fight. Their streams of gas cross streams, and the intersecting beams launch one of the men into the air. Screen 15 depicts one of the men firing his gas with such strength that a tree is uprooted and flies at the enemy, who run in fear. In screen 16, they take a break to refuel their bodies with fresh potatoes and food, while one of the samurai makes googly eyes at one of the women. Their refueling seems to have been overdone, because in screen 17, a catastrophe has erupted. The force of the team's farts blows over the entire camp and tents of the enemy like the winds of a tornado. People, food, trees, and tents go flying while one man tries to hold down his prized possessions in a box. This effectively ends the war. Or does it? In screen 18, an innocent cat has wandered onto the scene and one man wants to continue the fun. The cat comes too close and the laughing man blows it flying and spinning in the air when hit by an explosion of gas. Not to be outdone, two of his rivals let out one more blast and an old man is knocked into the air. With hands flailing, he drops everything and a scream escapes his lips. Some ask if this fart battle scroll has any real meaning or purpose other than to be humorous. Some have said it represents the hatred of many Japanese at that time for foreigners. Just 7 years later, Commodore Perry would sail his black ships into Yokohama Harbor and effectively end the isolationism of Japan. Others say it has nothing to do with foreigners, but is simply a satire of social conditions at that time. This opinion is supported by other fart battle scrolls from the same period, including a famous one that satirized the Boshin War by depicting it as a fart battle instead of the bloody, deadly war it was. The Boshin War effectively ended the samurai period of Japan, when the imperial forces supporting the emperor ended the samurai forces supporting the shogunate and moved the emperor's residence, and thus the capital of Japan, from Kyoto to modern-day Tokyo. Perhaps the fart battle scrolls were a safe way to provide political commentary. However crass or political or funny, the scrolls are now treasured pieces of art in museums throughout Japan. Art 6. The birth of the professional flatulist. The year is 1774. It is the middle of the day in Tokyo. A crowd surrounds a man who stands inside a show house next to the Ryogoku Bridge. They are about to see something unique. The man calls himself Nazuke. His talent is not playing the kodo or doing gymnastics. He is not about to give a traditional puppet theater show known as Bunraku, nor is he going to display talents with the katana. His art is one of a kind in all Japan, possibly in all the world. He calls his performance art Kyokui. Within the bamboo, wood, and fabric structure of the show house, he is about to give his first commercial performance of Kyokuhi. He bends over, exposes his buttocks, and begins, for Kyokuhi is best translated as acrobatic fart. Some famous cultural commentators are in attendance. Gena Hiraga was a polymath of Japan, much like Da Vinci in the West. He was an author, painter, physician, and inventor. In 1729, Genai had been born as a low-level samurai class who needed to support his meager income with farming. But he was an avid student of everything, and he was offered an official position with the local daimyo. He was sent to Nagasaki to study Western medicine, but he resigned from his clan in 1752 to pursue his studies, thus becoming a ronin. By 1773, he was a well-established teacher, master of painting, literature, medicine, and pottery. And now in 1774, he observes this most peculiar of arts, he says, of the experience.
The man was of medium build, fair skin, and had bachibinyako.
The bachibinyako was a peculiar hairstyle where the head was shaved in the shape of a shamisen plectrum. Genai says,
he wore pale blue clothes with a scarlet jacket. The performance begins with a happy fart. He followed by a fart. That was the voice of a chicken. Boo, 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 boo. Then he turned to the water wheel style. In this manner, he performed acrobatics like turning the wheel with his whole body while making boo, boo, boo fart sounds. He then begins performing kabuki stage music, followed by ladder and juzu farts. He did dog barking farts, the sounds of fireworks, and many others. He performed all kinds of songs in an ensemble, thus enhancing his flatulent skills.
Another commentator called Okitsu commented on the performance.
A master of farting came, and I laughed. On the 15th tatami floor, he did a standing fart, then a steady fart, then a kazumari fart. Then he covered his nose and said, this is the last song as if it were a 9-point ladder. He then rolled up his buttocks, which were covered with hair, and gradually pretended to climb up the ladder. When he reached the 9th step, his fart started to sizzle. It was a truly fruitful and passionate performance, and the audience was also amused by it. There was no smell. It cannot be a real art fart if it stinks.
During the performance, Nazuke stops and addresses the audience.
There was once a young princess who loved stories. She approached me and said, isn't there an unusual story you can tell me? I said, I was once a flower blooming man called Hanao, but my blooming flowers were farts, and I told all sorts of stories in my farts. I'll play you a song. Then a man nearby, hearing my performance, said he cannot write down the characters in my story, as they have no letters in our language.
Nazuke then performs a Sambaso fart song, in which he performed the stylized Sambaso dance wherein the gods make their presence felt. He performs a Gida Hyubushi performance accompanied by a shamisen. This is a type of popular puppet theater song accompanied by a Gidayu, which is the largest of the shamisen. In these plays, the narrator must speak all roles of the play and sing all meditations and commentaries of the action. Nazuke added a new instrument to the performance, his flatulence, much to the delight of the audience. He also performed kabuki songs called Naga Yuta while accompanied by the shamisen, and would delight the audience with performances of Ha Yuta, which were short love songs. Beyond the sounds and music of his farts, Nazuke would test his own skills for the audience. He would show how long he could hold a single fart, and he would expel as many fast consecutive farts in a row as he could. Then he would show various types such as the young woman's fart and a gentleman's fart along with imitating animal sounds. Perhaps even more disgusting, he showed tricks such as playing musical instruments by connecting a tube to his anus and adjusting his sphincter muscles to play the instrument. He also made a spectacle out of blowing out candles at various distances by farting. Most believe his ability to repetitively fart comes from a physical abnormality by way of a lump in his anus that produces a flute-like effect when he would adjust the amount of force applied. He could also inhale air through the anus to repetitively perform his art. Genai described him as the master of the musical fart, praising the ingenuity of the art and claiming it has never existed before in all the world. His performance caused a great sensation throughout the city. Nazuke became popular and wealthy, but he took his performance on the road for a few years and took a break to pursue other interests. During his absence, certain men in the city took advantage of Nazuke's new art form, and they tried to emulate him. They were called the Hepiri Otoko, which literally means farting men, or perhaps more elegantly, flatulists. They were professionals, and the audience appreciated them imitating animals, performing acrobatics while farting and showing off their skills, but the people of the city soon became bored of these imitators. The farting fad was passing. I guess you could say that passing gas became passe. Many criticized these demonstrations as vulgar, but ever the genius Genai rebuked them.
How dare you? Nazuke took a useless fart and sublimated it into an original art form.
But Genai did not appreciate the imitators who did not originate a new art but were simply copycats. After his four-year hiatus, Nazuke returned to Tokyo to become a professional flatulist once more. He changed his name to Fukuhira Mikuni, but he found that the originality of his art had passed to new fads.
4 years ago, on the side of the Ryogoku Bridge, I used the name Nazuke and was forced to fart to earn a living. I am well-versed in farting theory and will appear again.
Yet, despite his efforts, he was unable to find the same success as before. Except in one way. After the early performances, Genai became obsessed with the idea of a flatulist. He wrote a work called On Farting, which became his most well-known piece. This is a satirical work contrasting high and low culture in the Ryogoku Entertainment District of Tokyo. In it, he has a spirited debate with a samurai about a flatulist based on Nazuke. They wonder if he has to use a drug to allow this type of performance. Genai believes that this unique ability is so impressive that it should be commended. But the samurai argues that farting is rude, lowbrow, and only encourages stupidity, and that it thus goes against Confucian etiquette. To these samurai versed in Confucianism, these performances are an affront to the social order and propriety. Genai disagrees, saying they embody wisdom and creativity. They both agree that a fart is a useless discharge, but Genai believes that Nazuke turning the useless discharge into unique entertainment is what gives it value. Flatulists in 18th century Japan may have been a passing fad, but they make for a memorable and funny snapshot of an alternate counterculture of Japan, and perhaps it is not a totally dead art. In 1988, Kurofuri Hanasakyo staged a fart concert in Osaka. He took the stage name Fukuhei, which could be interpreted as meaning blowing farts. His concert was a big hit. Perhaps the days of the flatulist in Japan are not over for good. Only time will tell. I hope we have adequately presented an interesting and bizarre side of Japanese history without offending your sensibilities. In our next episode, we return to the dark and supernatural side of Japanese history and folklore.
This has been Mysterious Japan, created, written, and translated by Heath Havey. Thank you for listening and making this podcast possible. Please visit our website at www.themysteriousjapan.com for more information. Please join us next time as we continue to explore the dark histories and strange mysteries of Japan.